This morning's scripture is found in Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the certain of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to his impurity, to their dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's again my pleasure to have the duty of preaching to you this morning and sharing with you. If you don't know who I am, my name is Casey. I'm one of the elders here at Pathway. And you should probably know that this is our summer preaching series. This is not the normal way of doing business here at Pathway. Mr. Funkhauser is getting a much-deserved break from preaching through Matthew, right? And remember to tell him thank you for all the work that he does. But we're taking a break for, actually, it's a really big break. We're taking a 10-week break. This is the second week. And we're doing a series called Come, Let Us Reason Together. And I talked about it a little bit last week, but the goal of the series is to look at the really hard questions that come from believing in the Bible, that come from believing in the existence of a God. And we're going to actually look those hard questions in the face, right? We're going to look at our fears and our doubts, and we're going to do that because when we choose to do that, we find that we actually find peace. Because there are answers. There are good answers, and our faith actually finds rest in knowing that God does not leave us in confusion. A wise man once said that, named your fears must be, before banish them, you can, right? That was Yoda. last week I mentioned, okay, another quick note, last week I mentioned that I was wearing jeans with a hole in them because I'm not cool, as you probably know, but I just didn't own any pairs of jeans that didn't have holes in them. And thanks to my wife and Mr. Andrew Webb and Megan and Chris Funkhauser, I now have 6 brand new pairs of jeans. And so, I just want to mention before we get started my need for cash, okay? So, if anybody wants to think about that, that's totally fine. Okay, all joking aside, it's a real privilege to be with you here this morning, and I think this series is going to bless you. I believe this morning, I think, is integral to that understanding that we're trying to grow and develop and wrestling through the hard questions that belief in the Bible presents us with. So let me pray, and then we'll begin this morning. Our Father, we want to rejoice in the knowledge that you are a God of wisdom and of order, that our desires, not only for forgiveness, but for intellectual peace, can be satisfied in you. It is not given to us to know all things, but there are many things which you choose to give to us to understand. And so I pray for myself and for these people here and the people who are watching or listening that you will allow them, by doing the tough work of wrestling with the truths of your word, that they will find peace for their faith. They will find rest for their souls and the answers that you provide to the tough things of faith. So bless us in this time. Bless me. Give me the ability to be a blessing, to make myself clear instead of confusing. We thank you in all these things. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, so this morning, I threw a curveball to our slide people. I kind of changed the title. The title of the sermon is Understanding Unbelief. Understanding Unbelief this morning. And our goal is to, through this idea of worldview that we talked about last week, and I'll summarize that, is to gain an understanding of the world around us who does not share the same worldview that we have. Okay? So if you missed that last week, it's totally fine. I would encourage you to, you can go to our website, thepathwaychurch.com. Is that so right? Hopefully we can, what is it?
Pathway threads.
I'm way off. Okay. Never mind. See if you can search our church and get to the website. Probably by Facebook would be one of the best ways. And then navigate your way to see if you can find that sermon. Okay. Last week we talked about the concept of a worldview. Okay, and I want to give recap just real quick. Okay, real quick, we're going to do a worldview review. Okay, so I want to think about this real quick. Okay, a worldview is it's a lens. It's the lens by which our mind sees and makes sense of the world around us. Okay, so I want you to think on that for a second. Okay, it's the lens by which our mind, not our eyes, right? Our mind actually understands and makes sense of the things that go on in the world around us, okay? But this lens is not made of glass. It's made of ideas, okay? And through these ideas, we actually are able to make sense of what we see happening in the world around us. And let me give you kind of an example to help you understand this real quick, okay? That these ideas, they're not random, they're not frivolous ideas. These are big ideas. We may even call them stories. But through these stories, we make sense of our world, okay? One of the ways that we do this as Christians is, I'll give you an example, through this lens of the idea of creation, okay? This fundamental idea of creation, we are able to make sense of the world around us in these terms. And everything is understood in terms of creation, okay? So one of the ways I do this in my home is I inevitably end up talking about the human experience or myself as a human in terms of design, right? I'm a design, you're a design, and we're designed to function in a particular manner, okay? I tell my children, God designed us to sleep. And when we don't do that, we don't function correctly, okay? You see, I'm viewing the world through this idea of design, of creation order, okay? But we can change that, right? We can take that idea out, and what if we inserted the idea of evolutionary theory in its place, okay? And we would explain the world in terms of progress, right? That might be a good way to think of it, that we are what we are today because only the strong have survived. Only the best means have made it to this point. Okay? And you have to sleep 8 hours in order to function best so that you can survive. Does that make sense? See what I did there? There's an idea underneath the way that we choose to explain life. Okay? And we talked about this last week, so I don't want to launch too far into it. But everyone has these ideas at the foundation of their thinking. Everyone, everywhere. It forms what we call their worldview, their way of viewing the world. Okay? These are foundational ideas. And our goal is to have biblical concepts at the foundation of the way that we view the world in this lens. Okay? So that's our worldview review. Okay, if you want to learn a little more about that and the seriousness, the power of those ideas, you can go back and find that sermon from last week. Okay, but what we want to focus on this week is we want to use this concept of worldview and this lens to understand unbelief. We want to understand the world around us and the people that we encounter every day, okay? Because they have a worldview, and we need to understand that if we're going to understand them, okay? So we're gonna look through the atheistic lens, okay? We're going to look through the atheistic lens. That's going to be our first goal here, okay? And the way we want to do this is just real briefly, we're going to look at some voices from the past. Okay. How many of you have ever heard someone say that Christianity is a crutch for the weak? Anybody ever heard that? Okay. That it's kind of an amalgamism, that's not a word, but of the philosophy of someone named Friedrich Nietzsche. How many of you guys have ever heard of Friedrich Nietzsche? Okay, Friedrich Nietzsche, powerful influence in the history of the world, right? People today, we're still affected by his thinkings and his writings. Okay, but this idea, his understanding of religion was that religion exists, it came into being because the herd, right, the weaker people herd together and force morality on the strong people. It's really a struggle for power is what it is. Okay? The weak band together and they create religion and they project their meekness, right, of Christianity, their tenderness, their forgiveness. They project these things on the strong to keep the strong from exercising power over them. Okay, so religion came into existence so that the weak could protect themselves. Okay, that's Friedrich Nietzsche's idea. How many of you guys have ever heard someone say that religion is an opiate for the masses? You ever heard that? Okay, that's Karl Marx, right? Karl Marx. And talk about an influential philosopher. His ideas are responsible for killing millions of people. Okay, that's where Marxism and communism come into play, and they have been the destruction of many people in the world. Okay, but what Marx meant was that religion came into existence so that the upper class, so that the powerful could control the weak. They could control the masses. Okay, they created a system in which they could maintain power. It's a hierarchy, right? Okay, that's what Marx was concerned with, the overthrow of the ruling class. Okay, there's plenty of other people. Sigmund Freud said that religion came into existence. It came into being because mankind bands together in civilization for survival. But there's one thing that that civilization can't overcome. Okay, and that's nature. That's the power of the storm, right? And we have been from history afraid of the storm, the hurricane, the earthquake, all these things we can't control. And so what we do, what has happened through the progress of history, is that mankind created religion in order to personify the storm, that we can deal with it, right? We can't deal with just the chaos of not understanding why people die in a hurricane named whatever, right? We personify hurricanes, right? We give them names because we want to be able to wrestle with them and deal with them. We can appease a god, but a storm has no appeasement, right? We can't handle it. If it's a god in control of the storm, I can pray to the god. But if it's just a storm, I can't deal with it. Okay, so that's Sigmund Freud. Another guy named Ludwig Feuerbach. Religion came into existence just because people are projecting what they really want to be, right? It's kind of like our modern-day superheroes, right? It's kind of what he said religion is. Religion is just man's self-image of what we really want to be. We all want to be gods. We all want to be Thor, right? We all want to be Iron Man. Although Iron Man is just really smart. He doesn't really even have any superpowers. It's just like Batman. It's kind of like a pseudo-Superman, right? Okay. Superman, we all want to be. We all want to be demigods, right? Okay, that's what Feuerbach was saying. Okay, now I want to ask you, and I want you to think about this for a second. How many of you people have ever heard anyone claim that they did not believe in Christianity or God of in any nature because of these things or something like these things? Say, I don't believe that. Christianity is just a crutch for the weak. Anybody ever heard that? Okay, I've actually heard that firsthand. I've heard people say that to me. Okay, but there's a problem there. Okay, there's a problem there, and I want you to think through this with me for a second here, because we need to differentiate between arguments and explanations. Okay, that's what's going on here, arguments and explanations. Okay, because these thinkers who I just rattled through, and you don't have to remember any of them if you don't want to, these thinkers were not giving arguments for the non-existence of God. They were explaining the world around them based upon their worldview. They had already assumed that God did not exist. Okay, think about that for a second. They are asking the question of themselves, if there is no God, why are people so religious? Why are people so incurably religious? Why is there religion everywhere we go in the world? Okay, that's the question they're wrestling with. None of that says anything about whether or not there is in fact a God. Okay, and think about this just a little further for a second. We can ask the question, is it possible that Christianity, in Christianity, that people in their weakness look to their faith for strength, and yet Christianity still be true. Yeah. In fact, that's kind of a part of Christianity, right? We, in our weakness, recognize our weakness, and we look to our faith for strength, okay? But God can still exist, right? Doesn't say anything about whether or not he exists. Okay, so none of these are arguments. All of these things are people looking through their lens and explaining the world around them through their lens. Does that make sense? Okay, that's what they're doing. Okay, so there's a couple of things we need to distinguish with here before we really move on. And I'll try and be quick about it because I'm boring everybody to death here. Okay? The first is between belief and reality. Okay? Belief and reality. Just because you believe something doesn't make it real. And just because you choose not to believe in something doesn't make it not real. Right? That sounds really simple, but it's amazing how many people forget that that's true. Okay? If I asked you all to close your eyes and really concentrate really hard and believe that there was an elephant in the center of the room, if we all did that, would that in fact make an elephant exist in the center of this room? We can try it, but I'm going to bet it's not going to work. Okay? Because believing in something doesn't make it real. And all my believing in God, and I do firmly believe in the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus Christ and his glory and his deity and all those wonderful things and the truthfulness of Scripture, all my belief in that does not make that true. Okay? Okay. And if all of you tried really hard to believe that the sermon was about to end or that I wasn't up here, it wouldn't make it true. Right? Okay. So there's a distinction to be made. There's an understanding there. Belief and unbelief do not change the fact of reality. Okay? So when we talk about the existence of God, we're not talking about whether or not you choose to believe in him. That's not what I mean. I'm not asking you if you find meaning in the existence of God. I do care, but that's not what I'm asking in that question. Okay? The question is, does God, in fact, exist independent of you? And if he exists in spite of you. And if he doesn't exist in spite of you. Right? It's like the old question that's supposed to provoke massive awe. If a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? I actually have an answer for that question, but it's based upon my worldview. Right? And my answer is, sound exists whether or not a person is there to hear it. It doesn't depend upon you for its existence. The ear is an instrument of perception, but it doesn't create realities. Does that make sense? The sound's there. It doesn't care whether you're there. Right? Okay. That whole question is built around a worldview, right? It's built around an idea about man defining reality for himself. Right? If I'm not there to hear it, it's not really real. Because I wasn't there. Okay. Okay, second thing we need to differentiate between here is between relativism and reality. Okay, if you were here last week, and I realize I'm sitting here looking at people who I know weren't here last week. If you were here last week, we talked about whenever you hear that suffix, ism. How many of you ever heard of an ism? Everybody? Everybody's heard of isms because they're all over the place nowadays, right? Okay. Anytime you hear that suffix, I want you to think of the word worldview, right? That's what it is. It's a way of viewing the world. So any ism, atheism, theism, conservatism, liberalism, progressivism, socialism, they all have to do with ways of understanding things, lenses, ideas, okay? Relativism and reality, okay? How many of you guys have heard of relativism? You heard of that? Super prevalent idea in our world today. Super prevalent, okay? And basically what it means is, the best of my ability to explain and understand, is that all truths are equally relevant, which means whatever you believe is true for you, and it may or may not be true for me, okay? Whatever I believe is true, and really I don't care to compare those two things because I don't care, right? I'm just not going to deal with that. It's true for you and it's true for me, and they may be two totally mutually exclusive things. Okay, the problem with this philosophy is that people tend to only apply it to the realm of religion and belief, right? Because even the most dedicated relativist looks both ways before he crosses the street, right? This is classic Sproul illustration here. I'm stealing, which I should probably note here. I'll give my illustration first, okay? Because even the most devoted relativist knows that the car or the truck can't be true for the person driving and not true for him at the same time in the same sense, right? Everybody, when they pull out to leave today, is going to look both ways before they pull out. Even in relativism, right? The truth that all truth is relative can't be relative, right? That doesn't even make sense, because that means that some truth is not relative, okay, if you're following. Doesn't matter. Okay. I meant to point out at the beginning that this sermon is built around this book by Dr. R.C. Sproul, okay, called If There's a God, Why Are There Atheists? And I highly recommend that you pick up this book and read it. I would recommend you pick up anything by R.C. Sproul, but this book is a great book and will help you understand some of these worldview concepts, okay? If you haven't read it, I recommend it. If you choose not to read it, it's your own fault. And if you have read it and you didn't like it, there's something wrong with you. Okay. Okay. So,
relatively speaking,
that's relative, okay? Thank you, Mr. Funkhauser. Okay. Everybody sees those two distinctions, belief and reality, relativism and reality. Reality is what it is. But people tend to not like that to be applicable to what we call metaphysics, things beyond what we can see and touch. Okay, if God exists, he exists whether you like it or not. And if he doesn't, he doesn't exist whether you like it or not. It's just a reality. Okay. Okay. So now what I want to do is I want to turn the tables. Okay, I want to change our perspective here. We've just been looking through the atheistic lens at belief, right? That's what we were doing. But now we're gonna try looking at atheism through the biblical lens. Okay, we're gonna turn the tables here and do the same thing, but from the opposite perspective. Okay. So the good news is the Bible doesn't leave us to wander and try and figure this one out on our own. Because when we go to try to understand atheism through the biblical lens, the Bible just flat out explains it. And it's called Romans chapter 1, okay, beginning in verse 18, and you'll notice that Megan read that for us. Thank you, Megan. Okay. And so I just want to give you the 10,000-foot overview here of Romans 1. Okay? Romans 1, beginning in verse 18. Probably should have pulled it up before I got here. That's how I function. Paul begins by talking about that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Okay, so there's a pushing down, and that word in the Greek is very graphic. It's an image of a holding down, a pressing down, like the idea of a spring being stood upon. Okay. So, he says, for what can be known about them, about God, is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore God gave them up to the lust of their hearts to impurity for the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Okay, now I want to give you the overview of this, because we do not have time to launch into this section, because it is super, super dense in meaning and truth. Okay, so just want to give you the flyover here. Okay? So what's happening here is that God's just anger is being revealed and directed at something very specific. Okay? as men in their unrighteousness suppress truth. They push it down. Okay? So God's righteousness here is not, it's not arbitrary, it's not random, right? It's not like the gods of the volcanoes who just get mad and nobody knows why and we got to appease them. God's anger is very specific. It's very pointed. It's directed specifically at this unrighteous action. And done in unrighteousness is probably what it's really getting at. In pushing down truth. Okay, so what does Paul mean here? Okay, well, he's saying, and this is going to blow your mind if you haven't read this before, and you haven't really thought about what is being said here. Okay, God gives clear knowledge that is perceived. Okay, it's understood, it's perceived of his power and of his greatness through creation. So what he's saying is, God is communicating truths about himself through the created order, and people get it. It's not just that it's there and they got to pick up on it, or they're covering their eyes and they're walking around through life like that. Okay? God has made it known to where they actually got it. It's in their brain that God exists, and he's powerful enough to create all these things, and he's glorious. Okay? Everybody everywhere. This isn't just some people. This is meant to apply to everybody. This is what he's saying here. Why does God do this? So that they have no excuse. So that they have no excuse. Has anybody ever heard of the term called invincible ignorance? Anybody ever heard of that term before? It's a legal term, I'm pretty sure. Okay. What it has to do is holding someone accountable for something they had no way of knowing. Right? So if the city council of Troy this morning woke up and decided to suddenly change the law so that we had to drive on the left-hand side of the road and didn't tell anybody and sent the cops out and started arresting people left and right, they're going to have legal ramifications, right? But there are plenty of other things that you should know. If you go to another state or another country and you do something illegal and you say, well, I didn't know, they would probably say, well, considering you decided to come here, you probably should have looked into our laws. Right? You're responsible for knowing. Okay? So what's happening here is God is communicating the knowledge in such a way that no one has an excuse. No one anywhere in the world can say, I didn't know. Okay? But what happens? Okay, well, this is what happens. Because of sin, and Paul is going to cover this, right? We're just at the outset of Romans here. Because of sin. Excuse me, and sin is a universal phenomenon. Okay, because of Adam, everyone has been touched by sin. Everyone everywhere. Oldest to the youngest, smartest to the dumbest, wherever you live, sin is in you and is influencing you and is permeating your very being. Okay? And so what Paul says, because of sin, mankind refuses to honor God, and instead an exchange takes place. Man gets this knowledge, he perceives it, but he presses it down. He suppresses it. And this exchange happens, okay? Truth for lies, idols for God, light for darkness, wisdom for foolishness, and honor for dishonor. Okay, they exchange, mankind exchanges the truth, and God gives them over. His judgment is to remove honor from them. What makes mankind valuable? Well, it's because you're created in the image of God, right? It's your relationship to your Creator that makes you valuable. So God actually, because mankind rejects that knowledge, he actually removes that honor by giving them over to actions that bring dishonor. Right, and Paul actually is going to go on to explain that hits the zenith in sexual perversion. Okay, but we're really not going to dig into that today. Okay, so that's what Romans 1 is saying. Okay, but we want to dig down a little deeper, and I'll try not to drag this out here. Okay, we want to dig down a little deeper and understand why is mankind suppressing the truth. Okay, this is what I really want you to understand this morning. I want you to get out here. Why is mankind suppressing the truth? Okay, well, Dr. Sproul in his book, he gives us three primary reasons. And the first of which is the trauma of holiness. Okay, the trauma of holiness. If you've ever listened to a sermon before, or been in a church for any length of time, you've probably heard a sermon that defined what it means that God is holy. Has anybody ever heard that before? Anybody ever heard a sermon on holiness or an explanation of holiness? Not getting any hands. Either you're sleeping. There we go. Okay. It's participatory. Gotta help me out. Okay. So usually when we think of holiness, we think of moral purity, right? But oddly enough, that's not actually the primary use of it in the Bible, okay? It's got kind of a slightly weird definition. But what I'm concerned about here this morning is not that you understand the concept of holiness. It's more that we see how holiness affects us as sinful human beings, okay? What does holiness do to the human psyche when it's experienced? Okay, well, the good news is the Bible gives us lots of examples. Okay, anybody read Isaiah's experience of the holiness of God? Isaiah is drawn up into a vision. He sees God revealed in holiness, the glory being poured out. The angels present literally are designed with an extra set of wings to shield their face from the holiness of God. And Isaiah gets a full blast, right? And what is Isaiah's experience? How does that feel to be in the glory, in the presence of God? Okay, well, the good news is the Bible tells us, okay? Isaiah says, "Woe is me." And in biblical terms, that means he's pronouncing a curse upon himself. "Woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." That's what it's like to come into the presence of God. Okay, that's just a taste, but let's look at a few more examples. Has anybody read through the book of Job? One of the toughest books in the Bible to read through. I kid you not. Okay, maybe that's just me. Tough book. Okay, rich, beautiful, tough. If you've read through it, Job, over and over again, "I want to declare my case before the Lord," right? I want an audience with God. I want to tell him what is happening to me is unjust, right? That's Job. That's 9/10 of the book. And then what happens when Job gets an audience? When Job stands before God in the whirlwind, right? God comes before him and gives him the dressing down of a lifetime. Right? He says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? What do you know about how the wild animals are made and give birth and how the falcon soars? Who are you to stand before me?" And the funny thing is, if you read it, God never actually answers Job's questions. Because he is the answer, right? And how does Job respond? Job answered to the Lord and said, this is chapter 40, "Behold, I am of small account." Right? We just read 39 chapters of Job saying, "Just wait till I get to talk to God. Just wait till I get to stand before him. I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand upon my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." Okay? Think about that. Anybody ever read the book of Habakkuk? Little book toward the end of the Old Testament. Okay, we did a series on that a couple years ago here. Fascinating book. Okay? If you ever read that at the beginning of the book, Habakkuk is viewing, he's looking at his world around him, the people around him, supposed to be the people of God, and he sees violence everywhere. He sees injustice everywhere. And he cries out and he says, "Lord, where are you at? What are you going to do about all this?" And he says, I'm going to climb up in the watchtower and I'm going to wait, and I'm going to wait for your answer. Brilliant idea, right? Okay, well, the end of the book. After Habakkuk experiences the word of the Lord, God comes to him in his presence and in his holiness. We see Habakkuk in chapter 3, verse 6. He says, "I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us." Okay? New Testament. Okay, let's think about this real quick. New Testament. There's a couple stories that kind of give us a light into the person of Jesus Christ. Most people, when they looked at Jesus Christ, they saw a man. But there were glimpses of who he really was, okay? In Mark chapter 4, verse 36, you remember there's several stories of the calming of the storm, but this one in particular, Jesus is asleep in the back of the boat, right? Storm comes upon the disciples. It's chaos, right? The water's crashing in the boat. They think they're going to sink. They wake Jesus up. It says they were afraid. In the text, they were afraid. They wake Jesus up. Jesus stands up and says, "Hush, be still." He calms the wind and the sea. And the text actually says, he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Verse 41, "And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" Right? They get this glimpse of the holiness of Jesus Christ. And they're terrified. Last one, Luke chapter 5. Peter and his disciples have been fishing all day. They don't catch anything. Jesus tells them, "Go out, drop your nets over here." They drop them, pull them up, and the fish are just, they're breaking the nets, right? They're everywhere. Okay, what ought their response to be? "Jesus, let's form a partnership." Right? "We're going to go into the fishing business together." But that's not what happens, right? Peter comes and he falls down at the feet of Jesus Christ. And it's an Isaiah experience, right? It's almost a word-for-word, well, maybe not. But it's a very similar episode to what happens with Isaiah. He falls at his feet, says, "Away from me, Lord. I'm unclean." Right? So we have this repetition of a picture throughout the Bible that when people experience the presence of the Lord, they are traumatized by his holiness. It actually is a horrific, terrible experience. There's this experience, this evoking of awe, right? This unable to comprehend the whole picture. There's this humiliation. The proudest people come before the Lord and they are humiliated by his power. They're intimidated by his glory. Right? You would think when Isaiah came out of that vision, he'd have been like, "I saw God." Take a step back, folks. Right? That's not what happened. Right? He was humiliated before God. There's this concept of uncleanness. Right? People perceive, when they come into the presence of God, they perceive their own sinfulness with absolute clarity. There's no hiding the fact that you're a sinner in the presence of a holy God. There's this sense of the other, right? And I think this is one of the primary definitions of holiness in the Bible, the sense of the otherness of God. He's not like we are. He's alien, right? He's something totally different, and it's difficult to comprehend. Has anybody ever been, and I'm not one for ghost stories and all that stuff, but you ever had a moment in your life where you were somewhere doing something, maybe you weren't supposed to be where you're at, or dabbling in things you shouldn't be dabbling in, and you suddenly had the experience that something else was there? Or something was happening that you had no category through which to explain it. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? I had this happen the other morning. I went outside to go to work. I go to work very early in the morning. And I just happened to look up, and there was a massive line of dots. It wasn't a comet. A comet makes a streak, and then it disappears, right? This massive line of dots that took up like two-thirds of the sky, and I watched it over the course of about a minute. Track all the way across the sky. I actually took a picture of it. I don't have a clue what it was. Okay, and I'm sitting there in my awe for a second, and there's a moment of terror. I'm like, "What is this thing?" Right? There's this sense of otherness. Okay. Why did Jesus' contemporaries murder him? Why did the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law and all these people, why didn't they just love Jesus, right? Jesus was great. They absolutely hated him. Because when they experienced Jesus Christ in their sinfulness, he exposed them, right? they were traumatized by his holiness. This is what it means for sinful man to come into the presence of God, to be traumatized by his holiness. Okay, the second category here, I'm going to try and speed it up, is the fear of nakedness. Okay, why does mankind, when it sees the light of the knowledge of God through the created order, why does mankind suppress that truth? Because of the fear of nakedness. Okay, now the concept of nakedness is surprisingly a rich biblical concept. Okay, super rich, used throughout the Bible. Okay, but one of the interesting ways in which it's used is shame, right? This idea of shame before God. Jean-Paul Sartre, I think it was in one of his books, I think it was Being and Nothingness, talks about shame as a relational aspect, right? We feel shame in regard to another person, particularly when we are viewed, right? When we are stared at, when we are exposed, when we are caught by that other person. We feel this idea of shame, this idea of becoming an object before someone else to be viewed. Has anybody ever got caught dancing when you didn't think you would? Right? Caught singing when you sing like I do? I'll tell you a terrible story. You probably think less of me for it. But I was at work. This has been a couple months ago. Might have been last year. Working with a co-worker. He's actually my boss. But we were working on a sink in an office. A whole bunch of ladies have this office. I got a little kitchenette. It's got a little heater underneath it that's you don't want to know. Okay, we're working on this heater. Okay, and my boss is changing the thing on the end of the faucet. It's called an aerator. It changes the rate of flow at which the water comes out, just so you know. And it also incorporates air. Nobody cares. Okay, he's changing that. Leaned over the sink, changing it. I decided to mess with him. So I kind of put my hands around his waist and like kind of lean over him, you know, just to mess with him. And try to look at what he's doing instead of going around the side. That exact moment, one of the young ladies that worked there decided to take that moment to come into that little kitchenette area. Right? I couldn't do anything but laugh. Right? Okay, now I'm being funny, right? But this idea of being viewed, right? Being exposed, being naked before another person, not even just physically naked, but psychologically, our spiritual nakedness, right? Being exposed. Okay, there's a shame that's involved in there. Sartre actually accused God of being the ultimate voyeur, right? The unviewed viewer. He has the ability to see you, but you can't see him. He can see you anywhere you are. Talked about this idea of being stared at and reduced to an object. I think probably more than anybody, women know what it's like to be stared at by a man, right? And to be objectified, to be made into nothing, to be judged by man, right, before you. This idea right now in public speaking, right? It's polite for me to make eye contact as I speak, but not to stare at any one person, right? If I preached the entire sermon and stared at one person, you would probably not come back, right? You would feel judged. And oddly enough, if you think about the reverse, it's polite for you to actually look at me and not sleep, right? It's polite for you to look at me because you're meaning to communicate that you're paying attention to my words. But why are so many people afraid of public speaking? Why are so many people afraid to be stared at by the crowd, to be exposed, to be judged, to be naked, right, before the crowd? As a public speaker, one of the things you got to overcome is the feeling of judgment. The fact that you're not only listening to my words, but you're also judging the fact that I make too many hand gestures. Or that over the next few weeks, you'll notice I only have a handful of nice shirts that I wear, right? And I roll up the sleeves on them all because I have trouble finding shirts that have sleeves that are long enough. Okay, don't judge me. I'm cheap.
At least you don't say naked.
Naked. Naked. Chris has got a habit of saying naked in a redneck fashion, right? Right. Okay, but you see the concept, trying to illustrate the concept for you, but now we apply that to the bigger picture. And the fear of being exposed before the eye of an all-seeing God. Whatever you're trying to hide in the dark places of your heart, God sees it as if it's the light of noonday. You cannot hide it. You are before Him, bare. This terror of nakedness before God. Okay, the third thing is the threat to human autonomy. Anybody ever heard that word before, autonomy? It is a real word. I didn't make it up. You heard that word before? Does anybody know what it means? Okay, it means self. There are two words crammed together here, auto and nomos, Greek word. Self-law is what it means, a law unto oneself, that humanity desires to be a law unto itself. I want to define my own existence. Anybody ever heard of an automobile? Right, that's self-driven. Okay. When we talk about these concepts of worldviews, one of the most powerful concepts that affects us, okay, we like to think we have all of our worldview ideas under control, but the reality is we're all influenced by the worldviews around us. One of the most prevalent worldviews of our day, and by our day I mean last 100 or so years, is existentialism. Has anybody ever heard of that before? Existentialism? I'm not going to try to explain it. Okay. But essentially, one of the central tenets of that worldview is that nobody ought to define who you are except for you. No one and nothing ought to set itself over you like a mold. You should be free to declare whoever you are and who you want to be and how you want to be it, right? And out of this idea spawns all kinds of issues in our world today. Okay? Right? The sexual revolution, right? The gender revolution now that we have that's more prevalent in our day, okay? Nobody gets to define sexuality for you or what it means to be if you're a man or a woman or whatever you want to be. Nobody can say, right? That's fine. All those things find their roots in existentialism, okay? But at the heart of existentialism is this idea of freedom. The freedom to declare whoever I want to be is who I am, right? The human desire to be free to do whatever I please. I am the king of my kingdom. I am the ruler of my world. I set the law. Well, that runs into a big problem if you suddenly expose to the ruler of the universe. Because there can't be two sovereigns. There's only God. If God exists, you don't get to be whatever you want to be. You don't get to do whatever you want to do. You are not ultimately free. Now, that's a whole bigger discussion about what that means. It's the sovereignty of God and the will of man. And we're not having that discussion today. Okay. But the reality is, when mankind is exposed to the light of knowledge, and I don't think Paul means in Romans 1 that happens just one time. I think he means it happens over and over again. Right? Any time that you see glory in the created order, not just in the trees out there, but even in the human mind, right? When we find order, why is it that the fundamental rules of physics and quantum physics can be summarized in super simple mathematical formulas? Why is that? How many of you ever heard of E equals MC squared? What does it mean? Energy is equal to mass times, I don't know what C means, it's constant, right? Speed of light, squared, okay? Everybody knows it. It's easy to say. It's actually relatively easy to understand, but it's where we get our entire concept of the nuclear bomb from, right? It's not simple. It's super complex. Order, right? And when we experience these flashes of light and order, mankind in his sinfulness is traumatized. Okay? So super quick, because we're trying to wrap this up here. My wife isn't even in the room to give me the wrap it up signal. We're good. We can build a psychology of atheism. Okay? Psychology of atheism. All those concepts, we're going to smash them together real quick. Okay? when we think about understanding unbelief, okay, there are three primary concepts that can help us to hold all that together and make sense out of it. Okay, the first is trauma. Okay, sinful man experiences knowledge of God and His glory and immediately senses exposure, right? Nakedness, trauma, fear, judgment, oppression. And what does he do? Okay, well, the second concept we have here is repression. What does he do with it? He presses it down. He presses that knowledge down. He presses it down so far, he presses it into his, we could call it his subconscious, right? He presses it so deep down that he tries not to even remember its existence. That's why you can go out and ask anybody anywhere. He says, you know, I've read clearly in Romans 1 that you know that God exists and that he made all these things. They're going to say, what are you talking about? Right? They have pressed that knowledge so far down, it is a subconscious level of an issue. But, concept number three here, substitution happens. Okay, so we have trauma, we have repression, and we have substitution. When they press that knowledge down, it cannot help but come out in all kinds of different ways. And we call those ways idols. Okay? It comes out in all different forms of religious function. This is why, no matter where you go in the world, there are people worshiping. Because they were built as worshipers. They can't help it. But the things that they worship are now things that they can handle, right? They are things that they can deal with. They can't deal with the God who strikes terror in their hearts. But they can build a God after their own image. Right? Just like Feuerbach said. They can build a God that they can handle, that they can worship, that they can appease, that they can put into a box. That's the ultimate issue with idolatry. It's not just the imagery and the setting up of images. It's the control. It's the manipulation of the God that they're after. That's what idolatry is really about. Okay, so there's this welling up of worship. Even in atheism, okay, when we talked about worldview last week, we talked about creation. Creation is a concept that every worldview has to understand. And we asked, what is ultimate in your worldview? Well, in our worldview, it's God, right? But what is ultimate in any other worldview? What is the final thing that is above, that's there? Well, guess what? That's their God. Even in atheism, something is ultimate. All worldviews are ultimately religious. All of them. Trauma, repression, and substitution. Everybody's got it, right? Trauma, repression, and substitution. Why is there religion no matter where you go in the world? Because everyone everywhere has a knowledge of the truth. And they're pressing it down, and it's coming out of their pores, and they can't help it. Okay? Let's draw a few conclusions before we close. Let's draw a few quick conclusions. The first one is the evolution of atheism. Okay, I'm being ironical. I'm pretty sure that's a word. Okay, when I say that, because if you've ever studied history of philosophy or I don't know if really history would be the case, most secular explanations of religion filter that explanation through the evolutionary lens, and they apply it even to history. Everybody ever heard of this concept before? No, you're all gone. Just come on. Okay. Most people explain the origins of religion in that it first developed in this kind of animism where people worshipped rocks and trees and random things. Then it kind of grew into polytheism, right? There's a god of fertility, a god of fire. There's a god of this thing. And then it kind of progressed and it grew to gods of certain regions, right? And they had power over their region, and then it grew to a full-blown, developed monotheism, right? Belief in a singular God over all things, okay? Okay, that's an explanation. But what we're doing here is we're doing the opposite, right? We're going to explain atheism through the biblical lens. and it's progress. And we just did that. In fact, we can explain it in these terms. Why does atheism exist? Well, because mankind had a knowledge of the truth, and it couldn't handle it. It literally could not handle it. And so it pressed it down. But it keeps coming out, and it started to come out in all these other forms of religion, in animism, and in the worship of trees. And then it developed into full-blown gods over fire and bigger gods of creation and developed until finally just a full-blown militant attempt to reject any source of this trauma. God. Right? But it comes out. Comes out in some way, shape, or form. Okay, lastly, the final conclusion I want you to draw. This is really kind of important, kind of the heart of why I want to talk about this morning. Okay, the problem of unbelief is moral. It's not intellectual. It's not a knowledge issue, it's a heart issue. Why do people choose not to believe in the existence of God or reject truths of Christianity and all those things? Well, it's not because they're not smart enough, right? And sometimes we as Christians are guilty of talking in a way that talks about unbelievers as like they're dumb, right? How could they believe that? How could you really believe that whatever happened? You know, we evolved from germs to monkeys to people, right? Well, it's actually a pretty complex system of thought, right? Somebody worked really hard to work that out. It's just that it's not true. And the reason they believe that is because they are already committed to rejecting the idea of God. Because they cannot receive the idea of standing before a God in their nakedness. Okay? So, proofs will not ultimately convert anyone. Okay? And not next week, but the week after, we're going to talk about reasons for believing in the existence of God. We're going to talk about some of those. But I'm telling you beforehand, if you're hoping to convert your friend who's an atheist to believe in God, having a proof for the existence of God ain't going to do it. Because they are already committed to not believing. It's not about knowledge. It's about morality. It's about what you do. It's about sin. It's about shame and guilt. Guilt is fundamental to the human experience. Fundamental. You will go, no matter where you go, you will find people struggling with guilt. But strangely enough, if there's no God, there shouldn't be any guilt. Right? We want to engage these people intellectually, but our goal is to communicate grace to them. What enabled Isaiah to stand before God? Does anybody remember the story? If you've never read it, I'm doing you a disservice. Okay, but what happened? Why was Isaiah able to remain in the presence of God? Somebody shout it out. But right. The burning coal takes the burning coal from the fire, touches it to his lips, he declares him unclean. Okay? It's a symbol of purification, right? Of forgiveness. That's what people need in order to stand in the presence of a holy God. They need forgiveness. Okay, we talk about this idea of nakedness, yet there's this idea of covering, right, in the New Testament. The covering of Christ. That we find in Christ, the forgiveness of the blood of Christ that covers us. That's what people need. Ultimately, that's what people need to hear. Okay. We're going to transition now to our, holy cow, we're going to transition now to our celebration of the Lord's Supper.